is likely to be interpreted, what we write and what we say is likely to be interpreted if the laws we pass are challenged in court. So I'm particularly glad you were able to attend today. So why don't we ask our guests to come up to the podium in groups of however you want to do it. Welcome. Welcome to the committee. We are very happy to have you.
Thank you so much, Senator Burdick, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm a Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. I've had the pleasure of meeting all of you at the orientation session we did on the 17th, and it is my pleasure to appear before you again today as part of a panel on a very important issue that affects both the legislature and our courts in Oregon, and that's the process of construing statutes. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you two of my colleagues, Judges Jack Landau and Virginia Linder. And I'd just like to take a moment and tell you a little bit about them, because I think that's helpful to know.
Judge Brewer, if you would just excuse me for one moment,
course.
I would like to open a meeting of the full Judiciary Committee now that we have a quorum. Thank you, Senator Beyer. Please proceed.
Thank you. Judge Landau is a presiding judge of one of the court panels. He's a graduate of Franklin High School in Portland. He's an Oregonian. Went to Lewis and Clark College and Northwestern School of Law in Portland. Also has an advanced law degree from the University of Virginia. Judge Landau has been on our court for 13 years now, since 1992. And before that, he had extensive experience as a lawyer in private practice, and he was the Deputy Attorney General for the state of Oregon for a number of years. He's one of the top scholars and teachers in our state on the issue of statutory construction, and he's going to take the lead in our presentation to you today. Judge Virginia Linder is the presiding judge of the motions panel of our court, and she also is an Oregonian. She's a graduate of Southern Oregon University and Willamette University College of Law. She served on the Court of Appeals since 1997. Before that, like Judge Landau, she also had an illustrious career in the Attorney General's office in Oregon, capping that career as Oregon's top appellate lawyer, the Solicitor General. Judge Linder, like Judge Landau, is a very careful and clear thinker and writer, and she'll briefly describe for you the overall approach that the appellate courts take in tackling these problems. What we want to develop today with you is a dialogue that's helpful in explaining how we construe the statutes that you enact. And our goal is to go beyond a relationship in which we communicate to you only in the form of written opinions after the fact, when it's too late for us to have a clearer understanding of what you meant when you originally chose the words of the statute. And we're, of course, also here to answer your questions and to interact with you. So please feel free to interrupt us, and so this can be a conversation. And with that in mind, I'll pass the torch to Judge Landau. Jack?
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I just want to say thank you for inviting us. This is a real opportunity for us, as Dave said, to have a conversation. And before I go any further, I want to encourage you interrupt any of us with questions. We're here so that we can talk about the work of our respective institutions, and we want to be of help to you, so we can do that. If you have something in particular on your mind that you think we should address, just let us know, and we'll do our best to answer those questions. In general, what we want to do today is cover a couple different areas. We've had talks with the chair and staff and some of you over the course of the last couple of weeks, so we have a general idea of some of the things that you might find helpful. First, we want to talk a little bit about the work of the Court of Appeals and what it is that we do, and what it is when we review the decisions of trial courts and administrative agencies to determine whether they follow the law. And what we want to do is talk about what does it mean. What does it mean when we say we review those decisions to follow the law? What is the law that we're applying, and how do we know it when we see it? It seems obvious that we review, we look it up, we see what the law is, but it's not quite so obvious, and there are rules that have been developed over the centuries and by you, the legislature, that govern what we do. And so what we'll do is we'll talk about that first generally. Judge Linder will talk about how some of those rules came about, and then I'll talk about it a little more specifically. And we have some examples that we've given you. We'll go through some of those examples. We just thought it would be more interesting and more concrete if we gave you a couple of statutes to show you the kind of exercise exercises and the rules that we have to apply when we're construing statutes. With that in mind, we'll go through that rough outline. As Chief Judge Brewer explained last week at a briefing, we are the state's intermediate appellate court. We, in general, review the decisions of trial courts and administrative agencies to determine whether they followed the law. We are what's often called an error-correcting court. We try to make sure that no mistakes were made, kind of mistakes that would justify reversing and remanding for a new trial or a new hearing. We are not primarily a lawmaking court or a law announcing court. The lawmaking is primarily your job. Our job, as I said, is to make sure that the trial courts and the administrative agencies follow the law. We decide whether those lower courts and agencies committed reversible error by failing to follow a statute or a rule of evidence or the Constitution, and then we announce those decisions and explain them in written opinions. So what does it mean when we say we have to determine whether the agency followed the law? What is the law that we have to apply? First and foremost, the law is the federal constitution and any federal statutes. The federal constitution says that it's the supreme law of the land, and all of us are obligated to follow the federal constitution. This is something that you'll hear a lot about, I'm sure, as you talk about the United States Supreme Court case, the cases in Blakely and Apprendi and, after last week, Booker. It's an excellent example of the relationship between the state and the federal courts and legislatures. The Washington State Legislature adopted a sentencing scheme that allowed trial judges to vary sentences according to factual findings that the trial courts themselves made, not juries. And the United States Supreme Court said that system, which allowed federal judges to make those factual findings and not juries, violated the federal constitutional guarantee to a right to a jury trial. We can all debate whether we agree with the United States Supreme Court in Blakely and Apprendi, and some people do and some people don't. But once the United States Supreme Court says that's what the federal constitution means, the United States Supreme Court gets the last word. It's the supreme law of the land, and we are all obligated to follow it. So as a result of that, we had a case recently in which there were issues about whether state courts in Oregon making factual findings that affected the sentence required a jury trial, and we said, well, it's the federal constitution. The United States Supreme Court has spoken. We are obligated to follow it. It's the supreme law of the land. And so that portion of the state sentencing guidelines are unconstitutional. That's our job. We have to follow the federal law. Fortunately for us, actually few cases involve in our work federal law. By far and away, the vast majority of our cases involve state law. So let's talk for just a couple of minutes about what we mean when we say state law, because it means more than you might think. What it means for us is the state constitution. It means the law that you, the legislature, enact through the legislative processes, and it also means the law that administrative agencies promulgate by virtue of the authority that you give them in setting up administrative agencies and charging them with the responsibility of preparing regulations for fish and wildlife or environmental quality or liquor control or what have you. So when we say the Constitution, we mean the original Constitution, 1857, and we also mean any amendments to the Constitution that have been enacted by the initiative as the Constitution provides. The Constitution limits what we all can do. It allocates power among the branches. It also sets limits on how we can exercise that power. And so, although it's commonly said the legislature has plenary authority, you can enact legislation on anything you want, there are limits. For example, if you enacted a sentencing law that said, to pick an example that nobody would do, that if you're a burglar and you're black, you're sentenced to one a term of imprisonment, but if you're a burglar and you're convicted and you're white, it's a different sentence. I think everybody would agree that would violate the Constitution, which in Article 1, Section 20 says that you cannot discriminate against people on the basis of race. Right? So the Constitution sets limits on what the legislature can do. Some of those limits are procedural. So you have, for example, one subject limitations. You have to read your bills a certain number of times. There are limits on the extent to which you can enact special local legislation and so forth. And some of those are substantive. You have to be careful when you're enacting legislation that involves the rights of free expression, for example. And our job is to determine what that constitution means and whether or not the legislation runs up against any of those constitutional limitations.
Judge Landau, if I could just break in for a second. One of the things that interested me a lot when I first started learning more about the Oregon Constitution versus the federal Constitution was that in so many areas when it comes to individual rights, the Oregon Constitution actually is stronger in areas such as free speech and even my very favorite area, gun rights, than the federal constitution is. And maybe you could just address that a little bit and how that affects your work.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's absolutely right. And actually, that Oregon is almost unique in that regard in recognizing the independent significance of state constitutions. Every state is formed by the people of that state in adopting a constitution that's separate from the constitution that was ratified in 1789, but most of the courts in the country tend to just interpret the state constitution to mean exactly the same thing the federal constitution does. But in Oregon, beginning in the late 1970s, we recognize that state constitutions have independent legal significance, and sometimes their words are different. And sometimes the framers intended those words to guarantee greater protections of individual rights than, say, the federal constitution did. And so the courts have been interpreting those to give the framers of the Oregon Constitution the benefit of those decisions.
But in the converse, if the state constitution were to provide lesser individual rights, then the federal constitution would prevail.
No, I'm sure that's absolutely right. Whatever the state constitution means, because the federal constitution is the supreme law of the land, we can never grant less protection than the federal constitution requires.
Jack, can I ask you a follow-up question that might be helpful to the understanding of the committee, and that is the order in which we analyze legal problems. And Jack has referred to the federal constitution, the Oregon constitution, and statutes as being three primary sources of law. We often get appeals where a losing party will raise violations of all three of those things. And it matters for us to be efficient how we address those in order, and it relates to her question. So, Jack, how does that work?
That's a really good observation. To be efficient, we always look at statutes first. We want to avoid having to make constitutional decisions whenever possible. We will always decide cases on the narrowest possible grounds. So if there's a statute that applies, that's what we're going to look at first. We'll construe the statute and give effect to its terms. Only if the statute doesn't afford relief to the parties will we then go to the state constitution. We will never go to the federal constitution unless we first determine the state constitution doesn't afford you relief. And then as a last resort, we'll go to the federal constitution. So there really is that order. And Oregon courts are pretty strict about that. We really like the idea of the state constitution being given preeminence in our legal analysis. We only look at federal law unless we have to.
Could you describe what you mean by relief?
Relief? Sure. When the work of the courts is always initiated by either the state filing a complaint against somebody who's committed a crime or who the state believes has committed a crime, and or it's initiated by a complaint that a private party files against another private party who believes has been injured. And so, in a tort case, an automobile accident case, the plaintiff's injured, will file a complaint against the defendant and ask for money. And when we say relief, what we're saying is, what is it that the plaintiff who initiated the lawsuit is asking for? And the relief could be monetary damages. The relief could be a request that the courts declare the meaning of a contract or a statute. Or the relief could be that the parties want the courts to declare the constitutionality of a state statute or a provision of the state constitution. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
When I say that the state law that you make is kind of preeminent, I want you to understand we really like that state of affairs. We, as an institution, recognize that the legislature is the primary lawmaking institution in our system of government. We like it that way. That's your job. Our job is to apply that law and to make sure that the trial courts and the administrative agencies understand it correctly and are applying it correctly. So what we need to do is talk a little bit about what it means when we say, well, what does it mean? You apply the law. We were just talking about this before the hearing, Madam Chair, that it is, in fact, most of what the Court of Appeals does. If you had to count all the opinions that are published in the volumes of appellate reports, and we generate 400 or 500 opinions a year, and out of all those thousands of opinions, between two-thirds and three-quarters of those opinions are about statutory construction. That's what courts do nowadays. They interpret the law that you, the legislature, enact. That pretty much is our job description. Cases involving constitutional law, cases involving the common law, are actually the exception. The rule is that our work is to interpret and apply the legislation. Fortunately for us, in the majority of the cases, that's pretty easy. In most cases, the legislation's pretty straightforward. You know, when a statute says you have 30 days to file your notice of appeal, it's pretty easy to figure out if somebody files 35 days after the judgment, you're late. You're 5 days late, you're out. Unfortunately, there are some cases. There are usually a couple hundred of them every year. That may sound like a lot, but as Judge Brewer probably explained to you before, we get up to 4,000 new cases a year. So to say that there are a couple of hundred instances in which the statutes aren't clear is not saying a lot. Sometimes it's because of just the inherent ambiguity of language. I have no doubt that you're finding that out already as you go through your work in evaluating bills. Sometimes language is just inherently kind of a slippery thing. Sometimes the uncertainty arises from compromises that are sometimes a result of intentionally ambiguous wording. It's a way that you can get agreement among yourselves, and sometimes it's just a result of mistakes. With 3,000 or so bills in the course of the session and some 3,000 to 5,000 amendments, mistakes are bound to happen, and those mistakes are bound to get noticed by parties and end up in some kind of a lawsuit. Whatever the reason is, our job is to sort those out and figure out what the statutes mean. When we do that, we interpret statutes according to a set of rules that come basically from two sources. They come from you, and in one of the handouts that we gave you are some excerpts from ORS Chapter 174. That's a chapter that collects various general rules of statutory construction that govern the courts in our functions as trying to interpret the law.
And Jack, wouldn't you say that the vast majority of the rules that we apply in construing statutes come from the legislature?
Oh, sure. So, and we'll talk about that in some more detail. When we construe statutes, you have the authority to tell us what words mean, for example, and that's going to be the first place we look. Chapter 174, for example, has a list of common definitions. We're controlled by those definitions. You'll notice that the statute talks about the object of statutory construction being ascertaining what the legislature intends. That is the governing focus of any decision that you see. If you pick up any book from the shelf and look at our statutory construction decisions, you'll see us talk about just that. The other source is a series of cases that have been collecting over literally hundreds of years, from the times of the English courts to the present. Courts have been construing statutes and developing their own rules, and those have all been kind of compiled through some case law that developed out of the Supreme Court in the early 90s. And you'll probably hear a lot about PGE versus Boley and the PGE three-step process of interpretation. Judge Linder will talk a little bit about where that came from and why that's so important to us as courts interpreting statutes.
But, and as we talked about this...
Could you give your name for the record?
Oh, thank you. I'm Judge Virginia Linder, Oregon Court of Appeals, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As we talked about this presentation, I was giving my own sort of personal perspective as a lawyer who began practicing in this state in 1980 in the Attorney General's office, and we decided maybe that was a valuable perspective to pass an experience of the evolution of the law here to pass on to you folks. Around 1980, when I was first beginning to brief appeals and spending a lot of time, frankly, in the Department of Justice defending statutes in the process of that, there during the 70s had been a lot of major revisions of the Oregon Criminal Code, the Procedure Code, the APA, the Motor Vehicles Division. And so as I was just beginning to practice, there were still issues about the meaning of all those revisions of the code popping up. And the rules that Judge Landau is going to describe for you, the ones that hail in part out of Chapter 174 and that hail in part out of sort of years of case law development, were all around then. They were familiar and they were in the cases, and as I would write briefs or people on the other side of cases would write briefs, we would all talk about them, but it was fairly... It was kind of an unbounded game, if you will, in terms of which ones you talked about first or how you approached it. And sometimes people would start out with legislative history, and other times they'd start out talking about the meaning of the text itself, and other times they'd be throwing in these just kind of what Judge Landau will describe as canons of construction. And that was just the world as I knew it as a young lawyer was. You just invoked these principles a little bit arbitrarily, if you would. And as a result, it was unpredictable, and each case felt a little different. And what happened in the early 1990s with a case that I know many of you are familiar with, PGE, a case out of the Oregon Supreme Court, was that the court took all of those and fashioned a methodology, an order in which we would look at those things. And it didn't just do it with statutes. The court did that in all of those areas where we deal with, as Judge Landau described it, the inherent slipperiness of language, if you will, with contract interpretation, insurance contract interpretation, interpretation of constitutional provisions. All of those things, the court issued opinions eventually over the course of a few years in which the court tried to give everybody a common understanding of which things we would look at first and in what order. And out of that grew what we sometimes refer to as the PGE template or methodology. Now, people, at various times, some people are great proponents of that methodology. Some people chafe at it a little bit and feel a little hamstrung in terms of looking at what goes on. But what I can say, having lived through the period before that and now having practiced law in the period after it, is if it did nothing else, I think, it gave practicing lawyers, it gave sitting judges, it gave you folks as members of the legislature some sense of exactly what the court will do and how it will go about it each time it does it. And not in this kind of case versus that kind of case, but in every case. And then what hails from that, as you know, the other end of our process is to write opinions that explain that. And so we're very open to examination in how we do it, because every time we engage in statutory construction, we write out our explanation of what we did and how we got from point A to point Z. And the upgrowth of that process, I think, has been people can scrutinize exactly how we went about the process of interpreting the statute, see the steps we took, debate, if you will, whether they're the right steps to take in the right order, but they're the steps the Oregon Supreme Court has told us to take. And at least from one case to the next, and I think fairly over the 10 years or more that these kinds of methodologies have been in place, it has let people in the same way that the law does generally, try to structure their affairs, if you will, with some anticipation of how the courts will go about the business of interpreting statutes. And the structuring of affairs obviously includes you folks as you structure your statutes and begin to modify them and create new ones. So with that, I'll turn it back to our expert on the court, who will actually run through the rules. Madam Chair.
My question is more appropriate after yours.
No, if you have a question, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Jack Landau again. Judge Linder talked about PGE, which divides the rules up into three steps, and there are three sequential steps. And in every case where we have to determine what a statute means, these are the three steps we go through, and we hope that you understand what it is we do. I mean, this is actually a really fascinating exercise, because this is all about how your work intersects with our work. I mean, what you do is you tell us, the statutes issue a command, and then we have to figure out what that command means. And so in an institutional way, this is really great to talk about how the work of the courts intersects with the work of the legislature. Those three steps involve first looking at the text of the statute and determining whether the statute speaks clearly and unambiguously. If it does, we're done. If it's clear, if the statute says 30 days and somebody's 35 days and they're late, we don't have to go any further. We know a clear statute when we see it. If it's not clear, if there's more than one reasonable way of looking at things, then we look at the legislative history. We'll talk a little bit about what that means and how we use it and how you can get our attention through the creation of legislative history. And if the legislative history clears up the ambiguity, then we're done. If the legislative history isn't clear, or if there isn't any legislative history, unfortunately, we can't just shrug our shoulders and say, beat the heck out of me what you guys meant, right? We actually have to decide the case. Whether it's clear or not, we always have to decide the case.
So, Jack, let me ask you, if the text, if the words of the statute don't provide a clear answer, and if when we look for legislative history, we still don't know, do we get to just make the answer up?
We don't make it up. That's where the rules come in. We have canons of construction that are kind of tiebreakers for us. And so we want you to know what some of those tiebreaking rules are. The first rule, the first step, as I said, is we look at the text of the statute. If we are, as PGE says, as Chapter 174 said, we're limited in our construction of the statute by the words that you put in the statute. If there's anything that you remember from what we tell you today, that would be it. That our job certainly is to effectuate your intentions, but if you don't put the words in the statute that express those intentions, we don't have anything to work with. Okay. If you look at the very top of the page of the handout that Judge Brewer gave you, 174.010 says that the office of the judge is simply to ascertain and declare what is, in terms or substance contained therein, not to insert what has been omitted or to omit what has been inserted. It's probably the most quoted statute in statutory construction cases, and I want you to appreciate how much we take that seriously. If the words aren't in the statute, we're not going to put them there. If words are in the statute, we're going to try to figure out what they mean. We're not going to take them out. We deal with whatever you put in the statute. We have an example of just how seriously we take that. In your packet, there are some examples, and example number one is a statute. It comes from a real case, Young versus State of Oregon. In 1995, the legislature enacted an overtime compensation statute, and it says that the labor directly employed by a public employer is defined in another statute, and that statute says that a public employer includes the State of Oregon. It shall be compensated for overtime worked in excess of 40 hours, and depending on whether it's budgeted, you actually have to pay for the overtime, or you have to give comp time at time and a half. There are exceptions, and the exceptions are in the second statute. The provisions of 279.340, that's the one we just talked about, relating to pay for overtime, shall not apply to who? Employees exempted from overtime by a county, by a municipality, by a municipal corporation, by a school district or subdivision, because that work is executive, administrative, or supervisory. Well, what happens if you have a state worker who is executive, administrative, supervisory, or professional? Does that state worker get overtime? The overtime compensation statute says labor directly employed by a public employer, includes a state, is entitled, unless there's an exception, is entitled to overtime. We have an exception, and the exception mentions county, municipal, school districts, or subdivisions, and it doesn't say anything about states.
Let's suppose that was just an omission, a mistake, Jack, that the legislature might have intended to add the word state but just didn't do it. They forgot.
Well, and I'm sorry, as it turns out, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly what happened, was that it was just a drafting mistake that legislative council left out the word state. And we wrote an opinion in State versus Young that recognized that and said, you know, wish we could help you. But we take really serious that you are the lawmaking body. Law is defined by our Constitution as the words that you put on a piece of paper and, you know, the House votes on, the Senate votes on, the governor signs into law. And if the words aren't on the piece of paper, it's not law. And if the legislature makes a mistake, we can't rewrite the law so as to fix what we think the legislature probably intended. So it's, if there's, like I said, if there's anything that's critical to remember, it's that if you want your intentions to be understood, you got to put them in the words of the statute that we don't have any to work with.
I believe the word is now in the statute about $140 million later.
Well, and in fact, Madam Chair, even before this lawsuit was filed, State versus Young, at the very beginning of the very next session of the legislature,
correct.
This got fixed.
Yeah, Senator Beyer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, I was reading 174.010 first, and then this is a good example of, but what would have happened had that statute been written to not include any listing of a political subdivision? So if it was simply said that, you know, the overtime should not apply to employees exempted from overtime because of the executive, administrative, supervisory, or professional nature of their employment.
Exactly. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, you just hit on one of the points we really want to talk to you about today. It's this idea of listing sometimes and giving specific examples that can hamstring you a little bit. If you give more broad categories like the one you're describing, then it's all inclusive and you're not going to have this drafting problem. Every time you start to list specifics, and for example, in this case, you've listed a specific group that's exempt, but you've said that a very broad group the law applies to, you run that risk. So by doing exactly what you've described, you can word your way around this problem.
A follow-up. Okay, so then I think it's the same, but so if a statute specifically exempts something or specifically authorizes something but doesn't authorize something else by that omission, is it not allowed?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, you've hit on one of the really classic rules of statutory construction. It's a rule of negative inference. It's even got Latin for it. If it's expressio unius est exclusio alterius.
Showing off.
Yeah. dates back to biblical interpretation. The idea is that in documents of significance, when the drafter takes the trouble to make a list, a list of 10 things, if something's not on the list, then you assume whatever was not on the list was omitted intentionally. Unless there's evidence to the contrary someplace else in the statute.
Legislative intent, then.
One of the ways, Jack, we see the legislature work around that sometimes, and careful drafting, we see this all the time, is the idea that a group includes but is not limited to a specific category, or gives examples of the category that it applies to, but makes it clear it isn't exclusive. And so we see that sometimes, and that's very helpful information to the courts about whether that list is supposed to be exclusive or not.
I'll do it now, I guess. A particular statute, and we dealt with it 2 days ago in Commerce, the statute says that public bodies can share with other public bodies confidential information. But then it lists two specific statutes that the public body can share with this public body. Would they be able to share more than those two specific statutes to that specific public body that's listed?
But, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I couldn't speak to that one in particular, but I can tell you in general what will happen. It just depends on the context of those statutes. It depends, you know, we look at those rules, we look at that legislation, we try to figure out what were you intending to accomplish when you did that? Is there any other indication when we look at other parts of the statute that help us understand when you make that list, was it intended to be an exclusive list or was it intended to be an open-ended list? And it will just depend on the circumstances in each particular case.
Jack, that's the first time you've used the word context. Why don't you explain a little more, because I think it'd be helpful to the Senator to understand
sure.
what you mean by that.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, when we say we look at the text of the statute, that really covers a lot of territory. I mean, the text of the statute always includes the particular sentence. You know, when we're looking at 279.342, it includes that sentence. But I think, as you all understand, no words have meaning out of context. Words always change depending on the way you use them in context, and sentences can change depending on the paragraphs that they're in, and paragraphs can change depending on the larger sections in which they appear. And so the context of the statute will include the particular section. It'll include other sections of the same bill. It'll include other legislation on the same subject. I'll give you a real good example. If you look at example number two, this has to do with the definition of words. In general, you get to define words any way you want. If you want to define motor vehicles to include motorized skateboards, you can do that. If you want them to include tricycles, you can do that. All you do is you say motor vehicle means or includes or both. If you don't define a term, then we have to figure out what the term means. What we will almost always do is first look at a dictionary, because the assumption is we all use words in the ordinary way, and the best source of definitions about ordinary meanings is a dictionary. Our courts pick one in particular. It's Webster's New International Dictionary, in part because that dictionary is a dictionary that reports common usage, the way words are actually used, not necessarily the way that a lexicographer or some academy thinks words ought to be used. So it's a better indicator of what words probably meant to you as the legislature. The other reason is because it's the biggest dictionary in the English language. It's got like a 500,000 words. But we will assume, unless the context of the statute indicates something else, that that's what you mean. In this particular case, it ended up the context was really key. In this particular case, we have a statute that's about unlawful possession or unlawful manufacture of controlled substances. And the statute says that a violation of that, the unlawful production of controlled substances, will result in a particular crime category classification. And 8 means it's a really serious crime. It's more serious than it might otherwise be, depending on, among other things, whether the offender who was growing the dope was using public lands for the manufacture of the controlled substance. What does public lands mean? Well, in this particular case, it wasn't defined by the statute. And what the defendant argued was, well, let's just look at a dictionary then, because the dictionary says that a public land is unreserved or unappropriated public domain, open to entry, settlement, and appropriation. And he said, well, this land, in this particular case, is obviously not open to appropriation, because what was it? It was BLM land that was leased to Pacific University, and Pacific University had built a private lab on the building, and this guy was a professor who had, or an employee who had a little marijuana grow operation in this private building in the basement. So was that public land? It's in a private building on leased land. Or defendant argued, well, it's not open to entry, settlement, or appropriation, so it's not really public land. Well, is that really what the legislature intended? And so what we did is we looked up all the other statutes in the Oregon Revised Statutes and every instance in which the legislature used the word public land. And it turns out that there was a consistent definition, and it wasn't that narrow. That definition was basically any land that's owned by the government. Well, in this case, the land was owned by the government. So we said, we assume that the legislature uses words, the same words, to mean the same thing throughout the statutes, unless we have some indication otherwise. And so we
ruled
said...
ruled against the defendant in that case?
And so we ruled against the defendant. We said, yep, it's public land, and you're Category A.
There are a lot of people in Camp Sherman who better start to worry. Sarah Krasansky has a question.
Thank you. Justices, one of the examples that you're giving us was if the text of the statute is not clear, then you go beyond that. But if it is clear, you wouldn't even look at the legislative intent. It just stops at that point. So, or is that not true?
Madam Chair, Senator Krasansky, you're almost right. We always care about legislative intent. We assume that the legislative intent is what you say in the words, and if you say it plainly, that's what we assume is what you intended. If it's ambiguous, then we'll look at legislative history and try to figure out some other indication of what your intent is.
The reason I bring that up is I know a lot of individuals think that you will automatically look to see what might have been the discussion during the debates, but if it is ambiguous, you will stop at that point and not worry about what might have been in the discussion during the work session.
Madam Chair, Senator Krasansky, I might just add one clarifying thought about that, and that is that in a recent session, the legislature has passed a statute that gives the court authority to consult the legislative history without regard to which step of the process we're at. We haven't had occasion to delve into what that means exactly up to this point. Generally, we have just followed the PGE template, and the language of that statute, though literally read, isn't necessarily part of that three-step process, because by its terms, and I want to just check with my colleagues and make sure they agree with this, that statute would appear to give the court authority, to the extent it wishes to consult the legislative history at that first step of text and context. Jack or Jenny?
Madam Chair, Senator Krasansky, in the real world, we're always going to look at the legislative history. The parties are going to cite it in the briefs, and I'm not going to get to the point of the brief where I see the legislative history and say, oh, can't look at that yet because I haven't figured out if it's ambiguous. We're always going to look at it. Really what we're talking about here is how we craft the opinions that explain the decisions that we make, because if we decide that a statute is unambiguous, there's just no need to talk about the legislative history, whatever it says. Mm-hmm. But since we talked about legislative history, let's move to that real quickly. At the outset, just a caution. Legislative history is not a substitute for good drafting. So if you really want to get the court's attention about what you intend, put it in the words. Don't succumb to the temptation to say, well, we don't really need to worry about the statute's language. We'll clean that up in the legislative history. It almost never works, because if the statute isn't ambiguous, we're just not going to talk about the legislative history. What we do use the legislative history for is a case in which the text just isn't clear one way or the other. And we have an example of that. It's a fun example. In fact, we just talked about it in my class today. State versus Stearns. It's example number 3. ORS 803 describes the offense of illegally altering a license plate. Well, how do you illegally alter a license? What defines that crime? Well, it is
when the plate has been altered, modified, covered, or obscured. Well, what does that mean? What is it that you have to obscure in order to violate the statute? Well, it's any frame or plate holder that obscures the numbers, the letters, or registration stickers so as to make them unreasonable. But what happened in our case was we had somebody with one of those little license plate frames, you know, that says, I'd rather be at Nordstrom's or whatever it says, and it obliterated the word Oregon. It didn't affect the number, you know, the registration numbers and letters, the big ones, but it obliterated the word Oregon, and the guy was charged with illegally altering the license plate. Well, you look at it and you say, okay, Oregon, it is letters. And the statute does say obscures the numbers or letters, and it doesn't say only the big ones. On the other hand, if you think about it, why would the statute have been passed? It's a registration plate, right? And you have those big numbers there so people can see and the police officers can check and determine, you know, whether there's outstanding warrants or the plates are good, because the big numbers. But we couldn't figure it out on the basis of the text, and we went and looked at the legislative history. And as it turns out, there was a discussion in a work session of the committee that first adopted this, and there was a discussion of this particular issue, and it was really clear from looking at the legislative history that it was about the big numbers and not the word Oregon, and so that's the way we interpreted the statute. That's the way it works, is we look for an ambiguity. If we can't figure it out, then we look at the legislative history, and then we try to figure out, well, from the legislative history, is there some indication what you intended the statute to mean?
But don't you also have a priority, a kind of a tiered process for looking at legislative history, starting off with the carrying statement, and then don't you have to go pretty far to get down to the work session level?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and the answer is yes and no. Because there's not a lot of legislative history that is generated in any formal sense. In Oregon, the legislature doesn't create formally published committee reports like they do in Congress, you know, that are that thick and that have section by section analyses and whatnot. We'll scour the tapes of floor statements, of committee hearings, and look for pretty much anything we can get our hands on. But if we have a bunch of legislative history, there definitely is some legislative history that works a lot better than other legislative history. And let me just give you a couple of tips if you want to get the court's attention. First, as you're right, floor statements by legislators are really helpful. Courts like them for a couple of reasons. One is they're statements of you, the legislators. They're not statements of witnesses at a hearing who are not legislators. We're less inclined to put weight into what a witness says at a committee hearing, for example, because that's not a legislator. And often it's a paid lobbyist who's paid to take a particular position on a bill. And so if we're going to look at what a witness says, there needs to be some connection, usually in the form of a legislator saying, I like what that witness said. That helped me understand what this bill is intended to mean, particularly in cases where you're talking about state agency regulation and areas that require some expertise. Often the committees will rely on the statements of those experts, and it's really helpful if you want to get the court's attention for some member of the committee to make that statement that we are relying on the testimony of this non-legislator witness, because we will always give precedence to statements of legislators over non-legislators, and like I said, floor statements in particular. Also, floor statements are good because that's when the most legislators are in a single room at a time. Now, right now, we're talking about six or eight legislators, and there's a bit of a logic leap if you want to talk about, you know, what is said in this room being imputed to the 90 members of the legislature as a whole. So we're looking at the largest group, later in the process, legislators actually talking.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Burke. Excuse me. Justice Landau, in Oregon we have many more administrative rules and statutes, and some believe that state agencies are actually establishing law by expansion of those statutory authorities. How do you review the expansion of statutory authority by administrative rule?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's a great question. The legislature can create administrative agencies and authorize the agencies to promulgate rules. And in the promulgation of those rules, and boy, there really are. There's, last time I checked, there's about, you know, 4 or 5 linear feet of bookshelf space of OARs on pretty much every subject imaginable. The key is that the administrative agencies only have the authority that you, the legislature, give them. Administrative agencies cannot act beyond the authority that you give them. And our job in reviewing the validity of agency rules is always to determine whether or not the rules were promulgated within the limits of that authority. So, again, the key will always be a question of statutory drafting. And if you want the agency's authority to be more limited, the statute can limit the agency's authority. And if you want the agency to have broader authority, then you can make the statute say that accordingly.
So, Jack, just to follow up with an example, let's suppose that the legislature creates a Department of Corrections, and it gives the Department of Corrections express statutory authority to promulgate rules regarding the subject of corrections, period. Where does that leave the court?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly right. And there are statutes that give agencies just about that broad authority. And so we just have to deal with the statutes as they're drafted. I'm familiar with, for example, federal regulations that authorize the Environmental Protection Agency under the Clean Air Act to promulgate air standards that promote public health. That's it. That's the only limitation, is just promote public health. You know, we're a court. We have a statute like that at the state level, and a state agency is charged with promoting public health. We don't have very much statutory language to work with in terms of limiting the authority of the state agency. So it really comes down to how you want to draft the statute that defines the agency's authority. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
We were talking about floor statements. I just wanted to give, I couldn't resist giving one of my favorite examples that worked. It's just a real good example of how well it can work. So about 10 years ago, there were some substantial revisions to the workers' compensation statute. And one of the revisions was intended to, it had to do with the definition of what a new injury is for certain purposes. It doesn't really matter, but the point was to correct what the legislature thought had been an erroneous interpretation of the statute by the courts. And the Representative Kevin Manick spoke during a work session and explained what the purpose of the statutory amendment was, and he said very plainly, let's state for the record what it says here. This will do away with the current court interpretations of what is a new injury for responsibility purposes. Do you hear that, Court of Appeals? Do you hear that, Workers' Compensation Board? When you read the transcript of this hearing, this does away with what you've been saying. And you know what? We noticed. And the Supreme Court in Safe versus Drews quoted just that language and said, we get the message.
Senator Counsel Taylor.
Madam Chair, let me give you an example of what happened one time. We actually, on the floor of the Senate, made a statement similar to that for the purposes of legislative history. And unfortunately, what happened, it was the key part of the statement was made just as the tapes were flipped.
Oh.
And there was a gap there, and there was, I think, Reese Kissel was a lawyer for the Department of Justice at the time. Anyway, I think we found it was through the media. They had taped the speech at that time, and it was able through that to fill in the gap. But talk about coincidence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a carrier of workers' comp bills in past sessions, and I've had to, both in committee hearings and in my opening and closing statements, read text, I mean page after page of text that was prepared by attorneys, so that just for that reason. But how important is it? Because I know in that case, just so that it was, to make sure it was gotten right, they had the carrier on both the House and the Senate read the exact same words. Is that, I mean, if the two are saying the same thing? Does that hold more weight versus if one says one thing and one says something different?
Madam Chair, Senator Byrd, that is a great piece of advice. One of the things you'll see us talk about in our opinions when we look at legislative history is whether there's evidence that both houses had the same information and whether there's evidence that both houses had the same idea about what the statute meant. So, again, as another suggestion, if you want to get the court's attention about legislative history, make sure that there's some indication in both houses that the intention was the same, and that's a great way to do it. I also know of legislators, friends of mine in the past, who have actually planned colloquies. They've planned questions and answers on the floor. So, you know, Senator Smith, if I understand correctly, the effect of the bill is, and then you explain it, and Senator Smith says, yes, that's exactly what we intend. Courts love that stuff because it really helps us understand in a concrete way what you intended the statute to mean.
We probably should have heard that before we assigned our first bill to Senator Whitsitt earlier last week. Are you done, Roger? Senator Krasinski.
And I guess following up with Senator Virus says, I mean, if you have the carrier basically making some statements, is the court going to rely exclusively on those statements as compared to someone that might ask questions of the carrier and give a, let's say, different flavor of what they think it means? Because, I mean, basically what I'm hearing now is basically we're going to be going to the floor, we're going to have our own script, and we're going to be telling you this is what we mean. And unless someone stands up and says, no, I don't think that's what it means, and then it's going to basically put it back into the ambiguity, I would assume.
Madam Chair, Senator Krasinski, the basic idea is that carriers are given a little extra weight. And particularly if there's nothing in the record that suggests that anybody objected, right? The floor is where the members of that House have an opportunity to say, whoa, wait a minute, I have a question about that. So if we don't see any questions, we're going to assume that everybody must have agreed. You know, we have to do something. And we think it's a fair assumption that if the carrier of the bill, who's usually given a little more credence as somebody who spent the time in the committee usually and has a little more of the expertise, and if we don't hear any complaints, we're more likely to give that weight. If there is a debate, then it'll just depend on the nature of the debate. Opponents of a bill, for example, their comments, depending on the case, are given a little less weight because, what, they're opposing the bill. And proponents, on the other hand, just depending on the nature of the debate, will probably be given more credence because they won. And so we can assume that a majority of that House agreed with the proponents because they won.
Jack, just to follow up on that a bit, how often would you say we really see truly conflicting legislative history on these key issues as opposed to a situation where what we're really looking for are clues, where some of the legislative history points in one direction, another may point a little bit in a different direction, but they don't exactly match up? How does that work out for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in very, very few cases do we actually see conflicts in the legislative history, so that we have to sort those kinds of things out. Most of the time, our problem is that the issue before us is something nobody thought about. Really, that's the problem that we get most of the time. It's just one of those drafting things nobody thought about. And that's why we're here, is because it's a conflict. It's not clear from the language of the bill, and apparently it's just not something that the legislature thought of, and so we don't see something really clear from the legislative history. And that gets us to the third and final step, which is the canons of construction. Those are just rules. As I said before, if we get to that spot when the legislative history isn't speaking to the issue and the text isn't quite clear, we can't just throw up our hands and say, I don't know. We have to have the statute mean something. And so the courts over the years have developed some assumptions. One of those assumptions, for example, is if you have two competing constructions of the statute and one of them might be unconstitutional, it doesn't even have to be clearly unconstitutional, but if it even raises constitutional questions and the other is pretty clearly okay constitutionally,
we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and assume that as between those two, you probably meant the constitutionally safer one. In a similar vein, if you have two competing statutory constructions, one of which would lead to what we call an absurd result, and another one wouldn't, we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and say they probably wouldn't have interpreted it that way. They probably meant it to mean, you know, we get to bring common sense to the bench. And so when we're stuck on a really difficult statutory construction problem, we just assume that the legislature was using common sense. And that it wouldn't have done something that strikes us as just a little odd, even if that's a plausible construction of the language. In other cases, we just have kind of rules. If, for example, we can't figure out whether a statute's retroactive, doesn't say anything in the text, doesn't say anything in the legislative history, we'll just presume as a matter of law that it's prospective only. Just because it's the safer thing to do. As a matter of policy and as a matter of constitutional law.
Does that apply to your interpretation of U.S. Supreme Court decisions as well?
You want to take that one?
Be my guest. We follow their rules, Madam Chair, not our own in that regard.
Thank you. Before you go too much further on the legislative history, I wanted you to address, and we are starting to get short on time, but I wanted you to address how you go about, or if you go about, determining legislative history when you are faced with a challenge of an initiative. Where the words are not clear, how do you determine legislative history then?
Madam Chair, this is a great question. The answer in brief is we follow the same three-part method. We first look at the text of the initiative, and if the initiative is unambiguous, if it's clear, we'll just apply it however the words work. If it's ambiguous, then we look for legislative history. Well, we don't have a legislative session to look at, but we'll look for other evidence of what the voters probably intended the initiative to mean. The principal resource there is the voter's pamphlet, and we will look at the ballot title containing the summaries of the bill, of the proposed initiative, and we'll look at the statements in opposition and in favor. And I know in some cases we've even looked at newspaper accounts and editorials and tapes of television news articles about the bill.
Do you ever look at campaign materials put out by the proponents, in particular of an initiative?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any case in which we've done that, but again, what we're after is what the legislature intended. In cases of the initiative, the legislature is the people, and I can't see any reason why we wouldn't look at anything that reasonably would give us some kind of clue about what the people intended the initiative to mean.
So the legislature is the people, not the chief petitioners?
Exactly. It's the people who voted on the bill, just as in the case of legislation that's been enacted by you, the drafter of the bill or the proponent who sponsored the bill isn't the person whose intentions control. It's your intentions, since your votes are the ones that enacted into law.
Good analogy. Thank you.
Well, that pretty much wraps up what we wanted to talk about. In terms of the three-step process, I mean, in a nutshell, you are the policymaker. You make the law. You express the law in words that are put down on paper and voted into law. Our job is to give effect to those policies by interpreting the language. We do that by first looking at the text in its context. If you have definitions of terms, we'll look at them, and those will control. And if they don't, we'll look at dictionaries and the context of the statute, try to fill in the blanks. If the statute's ambiguous, then we'll look at the legislative history to try to figure out which from the competing ambiguous or interpretations of the ambiguous text are the ones that you intended. And if we can't figure that out from the legislative history, then we're going to look at a series of tie-breaking rules, again, just as a substitute for evidence of what you intended. If you have any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
And Madam Chair, maybe I just would say one other thing about this. I think sometimes the question comes up as to whether the courts are trying to make law where the legislature has spoken. And I hope that one abiding message comes through from this group today, and we speak for our court. I'm sure the Supreme Court would give you the same answer, but coming from our court in particular, we know we're not the legislature. We don't want to be the legislature. Our government is set up in three branches, and there's a constitutional requirement that the powers of government be separated into the three branches, and it is never, ever our intent to undermine legislative intentions. Never. Our goal is simply to understand what you're trying to say as best we can. There have been a few occasions since I've been on the court where we've looked at the words of the statute in context, we've looked at the legislative history sometimes, and really not been sure what you meant to do. We still have to have an interpretation of the statute. And I can tell you that where that certainty doesn't exist, the court is very reluctant to do anything that would make us look like a policymaker. We know that's not our job. And so hopefully this conversation makes that point clear, and we've been of some help. And the other thing we want to make sure we do, both today and any time in the future, you want to get back together again, is answer the questions you have. So do you have others?
Thank you very much. And we are getting back together again on February 10th to hear two Blakely-related cases argued before your court, followed by lunch. And I'm really looking forward to that. And I really appreciate this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And now, for our next event, we have an overview of Oregon's tort law by our tortfeasor-in-chief, acting legislative counsel, David Hendricks.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I am Dave Hendricks, acting legislative counsel, and I was asked by the counsel to stop by today and give a brief presentation on sort of introductory torts, which hopefully will not bore you too much to tears, and I will try to keep it fairly brief if I run through the outline here. The reason counsel thought this would be a good idea is because everybody's heard about tort reform, but not everybody may be too sure about what torts are and how they work. So the first question in a presentation like this that I think you need to look at is, well, what is a tort? And it's pretty easy. A tort is simply a wrong that someone has done to somebody else, and more significantly, a wrong for which the law provides some remedy. You just have the Court of Appeals talking about remedies provided by courts, and a tort is, there are obvious ones. There are the things like the fellow who runs into you while you're sitting at a stop sign. There are things like professional malpractice, etc. But all we're talking about here is situations where the courts have said at one time or another that this is the sort of thing that if you do it to somebody else, they're going to be able to come back and sue you and recover some sort of remedy. Now, the judges from the Court of Appeals who were just here told you that 60-70% of what they do is interpreting statutes. Tort law is one area where that is not true. Tort area is one of those areas that's still pretty much within the province of the courts, their case law. If you go into the statutes and try to find out what it is that you can sue someone for, when it is you can sue for negligence, for instance, you won't find anything in the statutes about it. You have to actually go to the cases, and these are frequently case law that goes back from before statehood, goes all the way back to England, before we are even a nation. And so tort law is that one of those areas where the statutes simply haven't taken over yet. The only thing that we have done is gone in and started to establish some rules about procedures and rules for certain aspects of damages and other things. And I gave you a copy of Chapter 31. This is a brand new chapter. We just created this when we were editing the ORS this last year, because we had several of these laws relating to torts that were kind of spread around the ORS and in really inappropriate places, and we finally decided it's time to bring it together in one chapter and say, okay, here's the statutory law, or a good part of it that relates to tort actions. And it includes a lot of the stuff that's been enacted over the last 15 years primarily, or 20 years, relating to restrictions, limitations, et cetera, on how you go about bringing a tort claim. The third item on the outline talks about some of the different kinds of torts, and I will tell you, intentional torts are just what they sound like. It's where the person really does intend to harm you. Obvious example, if Mr. O'Leary came over and punched me in the face, he obviously intended to do that, and we, even though it may be true that I might have had it coming for one reason or another, the law will still say that would not be an appropriate way to express the fact that that I had said something wrong. And so they would give him a cause of act, give me a cause of action against him to recover from medical damages and other damages I might have by reason of that conduct. Usually you don't get many bills about intentional torts. They do not create a lot of issues. I mean, I think everybody recognizes when someone goes out and intentionally harms somebody else that there should be a remedy for that, and you don't see a lot of bills on about those sort of issues. The real bills usually come in, and the real issues come underneath negligence. Negligence.
Before you move to negligence, when you have an intentional tort like the one you mentioned, it can also be a criminal act. So you have, are those just completely separate proceedings?
They are two separate proceedings, although there are certain elements of compensation for the victim that have crept into the criminal law before the meeting when you're talking about restitution for victims. And what that really comes down to is it provides the victim in a criminal action the ability to get what they could have gotten if they wanted to bring the civil action, i.e. a judgment against the wrongdoer for the amount of damages suffered by the victim by reason of that act that was both criminal and also a tort. It created both a criminal cause of action against and a right to restitution, as well as ability for the victim to sue separately if they wanted to. And we've had numerous cases, high-profile cases. You look at the O.J. Simpson case, where we had the criminal case based on the murder where the defendant was acquitted, and then we had a separate civil case by the survivors for the wrong that was committed by reason of the crime and where there was a judgment for the plaintiff in the civil case. And that was a tort action, a wrongful death action to recover for the death of the victim. As I said, negligence is where you really see the interest in torts, and particularly, of course, right now, professional negligence and doctors, et cetera, highlighted by the ballot measure we just had that barely failed to pass relating to caps on damages, certain damages against doctors. All tort law and negligence law has intimate tie-in with insurance. It's inevitable. They did a huge bill in 1987 that was a tort reform bill. It holds the record for the most amendments proposed to any bill that our office has ever prepared that I'm aware of. It was 125 proposed amendments. And that bill, when you looked at it and pulled it out, it was about, there was a certain portion of it that was what I would call true tort law, you know, who's responsible, limitations, et cetera. The rest of it was about insurance, because whenever you talk about torts, you're talking about liability issues and you're talking about insurance for those liability. When you talk about professional negligence, malpractice, et cetera, you almost have to also talk about the insurance component of it. Now, I'm not going to say too much about statutorily created causes of action as well. We do have a good number of them when you start going through and looking that the legislature has created. And I usually have drafted a few every session that have come through where frequently what happens is the bill comes to our office to create a crime. It gets a fiscal impact statement on it because all crimes cost money to prosecute and to incarcerate folks. And then I get a request to do an amendment to turn it into a civil cause of action. And we've had numerous bills that has happened to over the years. I remember sports officials. We had one in to create a crime for assaulting a sports official. It ended up passing as a law creating a civil cause of action to go out and sue and get certain things you couldn't get in a normal court action. Those are statutorily created causes of actions, and we do have any number of them on the books. We also have lots of statutory limitations on liability. The judges from the Court of Appeals talked specifically about that when they were talking about the statute that related to public land and the liability for use of it. That is actually the second one there under the fourth item, recreational use of land. It's that specific statute. They passed that. It's a fairly old statute. It's been revised over time. But it creates limitations on the ability of people to bring civil causes of action. There are constitutional issues lying underneath this, and I'm hoping I'll get to them at the very end, because certainly those constitutional issues have been driving a lot about what's going on in court law in the last few years, including the ballot measure that you saw on the ballot last time about caps on damages for medical malpractice. Remedies, item 5 down here. Usually the remedies are divided between economic and non-economic damages. Non-economic damages, economic damages is kind of what it sounds like hospital bills. It also includes things like lost earning ability, et cetera, that you can recover in a tort claim. Non-economic damages tends to be the controversial aspect. It's usually the pain and suffering. That's the real, that's where a lot of the issues come up with is on damages for non-economic damages. The ballot measure would have put a cap on non-economic damages, essentially pain and suffering. They're significant in medical malpractice because you frequently have a case where if someone is injured and they claim that it was by reason of a medical procedure, frequently they will be looking at a long period of time of maybe their whole life where they perhaps are disabled, they're in pain. And when that gets before a jury, that can be, a lot of times, the economic damages, the things you can show you're going to have out of pocket, are a small part versus what the jury is going to be looking at to say, what should we award this person to compensate them for the fact that for the rest of their life they're going to have pain, et cetera. And those can be a very large component of a judgment in those types of actions. Punitive damages are not usually awarded in just a simple negligence action. And the example I usually give is a situation where a person's driving down the street, they fail to see the stop sign, and because they're distracted, they hit the car coming through the other way with the right of way. Just simple, I got distracted, I'm supposed to keep my attention up. You get sued based on negligence. The second example is I'm driving down the street and I'm drunk and I miss the stoplight, not because I'm just distracted, but because I'm drunk, because I'm not paying attention, I can't pay attention, I'm impaired. So I go through, I hit the other car, bam. In those cases, the courts over the years have said, well, there are going to be cases where you have something that they refer to as gross negligence, and we're going to say in those cases there should be some punishment. There should be money award, not only to say to make the other person whole, but also to punish the wrongdoer by saying you're going to pay something extra for the fact that you engaged in this kind of conduct. You can almost always get punitive damages for intentional torts. So if Mr. O'Leary comes punches me, I can almost always make an argument to the court that not only should he pay for my doctor bills and such permanent disfigurement as I may suffer by reason of that act, but that he also ought to be punished so that he doesn't do it again, because society doesn't want people going around doing that. The thing you have to understand is by reason of laws that are now in Chapter 31, a lot of the incentive to seek punitive damages have been significantly reduced. For one thing, 60% of all punitive damages that are recovered go to the Crime Victims Assistance Program. So if you say you get $1 million on a punitive damage because someone did something really bad, pursuant to law, 60% of that, $600,000, should go to the Department of Justice and be available to fund payments for crime victims where the wrongdoer doesn't have money to pay. Because as we all know, it's nice to be able to say we're going to get restitution from the wrongdoer to pay the victim. Unfortunately, I suspect the great majority of wrongdoers don't have resources to pay. And so there is a fund out there to help make payments to victims, and that is to a large degree funded by money that comes in from punitive damage recoveries and civil actions. The other thing is that we've put in pleading requirements, et cetera, to make it harder. You can't just file a complaint anymore saying, I'm going to sue Mr. O'Leary and I'm going to ask for punitive damages. When you file that thing, you're going to have to leave that out. You're going to have to go in and get the court to agree that you've got basically a good reason to be able to plead that. And so they have done some things to limit the ability to have complaints in the initial initial complaint. Attorney's fees, the important thing to know there is in Oregon, you do not get attorney's fees normally in a tort action. The rule we follow in Oregon is that the only way you get attorney's fees is if you have a contract providing for attorney's fees or you have a specific statute you can point to that authorizes an award of attorney's fees. So in the average tort claim action, you normally do not get an award of attorney's fees. There's an exception for small actions. If you're only claiming about 7,500 now, for smaller action, there is a provision providing for award of attorney's fees. That was put in to prevent the defendant from simply saying, look, you sue me on this $5,000 claim, and by the time you get done paying your attorney, you're not going to have anything left anyway. So, you know, that would basically prevent, in many cases, anybody being able to recover for those smaller claims. So they said, look, if it's a small claim, there is a provision in that law, though, that says the plaintiff has to notify the defendant and give them an opportunity to pay up before they go to court. And if they have to give them a chance to do right and pay the amount before they bring the action. But if they refuse to pay up, then they can go to court and seek recovery and get attorney's fees if they do finally get a judgment. I'm not going to say much about statute of limitations. A very complicated area. You do usually see a fair number of bills or some number of bills over the years, frequently in the context of what's called product liability, where you sue a company for a product that they produce and you claim it's dangerous or defective. And it's an interesting one because the statute of limitations there is based on when you discovered the injury or when the injury occurred, but there's a limit on how many years after the product was put into the stream of commerce that limits you. So, for instance, if you buy a car used and it's 15 years old, if you go out and you have an accident and you think it's because the vehicle was defective, you're going to be out of luck because the statute of limitations is 8 years, basically, from the time that car was first sold to bring that cause of action. It can go up to 10 years under certain circumstances. But generally, it's a limit based on when that vehicle or when it was put into the stream of commerce. Briefly, on comparative negligence, I throw this in here because this is one of the areas where I've seen bills come forward, and I've always felt sorry for the committee if you're not an attorney who does this sort of thing because it's so confusing. Comparative negligence deals with scenarios where you have more than one defendant. You're suing more than one person for the injury that's been done to you. And you may think that might not happen very often, but in such cases as, for instance, medical malpractice, it's usually the case that there's more than one defendant. Frequently, the hospital is sued, the doctor is sued, the anesthesiologist is sued. You sometimes will have any number of people as defendants in the action. And the question that comparative negligence tries to answer is, well, how much should each of these individuals have to pay towards the loss suffered by the plaintiff? And by the way, if the plaintiff is more than 50% at fault themselves in the accident. With car accidents, this is frequently an issue. Who, you know, even though I'm the one who's suing, the other guy may say it was really your fault. And so, well, you shouldn't be able to recover from me. So if they can show that I was more than 50% at fault, end of case for me, I'm not going to get a recovery. But let's assume that I'm purely innocent, it's a medical malpractice, and you're bringing a suit for three different people. What comparative negligence does is say basically that each of the parties you sue, you're going to attribute a percentage. The jury is going to attribute a percentage of fault. Maybe it's 10%, 50%, 40%. And generally underneath our statute now, it says what you're assigned is what you have to pay. That didn't used to be the case, and it was a big issue over the years. But what's happened now is basically it says if you get 40% liability, you're going to pay 40% of the damages. If you get 10%, you're going to pay 10. And the one exception is, when you go look at these statutes, is there's a provision now in the statutes that says that if the plaintiff can show after a year that one of these defendants is basically a turnip, can't recover from them, that the court can go back in and reallocate that person's share to some of the other defendants. There's a limit. You've got to be up at, I forget where it's at. You have to have at least a certain amount of liability involved, but you can actually go back in and say one of the other parties, even though they were only found 50% at fault, might end up paying more of the damages if one of the other defendants. That was a huge battle back in 1995, and that was the compromise they arrived at that point. I might say quick thing, I think my time's running out here. I don't want to keep you here all afternoon. And do stop me if you have questions, or you can save them, whichever. Torts Claim Act deals with lawsuits against public bodies. The thing to understand there is that underneath, when Oregon became a state in 1857, it had something called sovereign immunity. And it was based on the old English concept that the king could do no wrong.
You said 1857.
Excuse me, 1859.
Okay.
I get that confused now because the cases all talk about 1857, not 1859. And when you hear the judges talking here, when they, on a lot of these constitutional cases, they're going back and trying to find the intent of the original drafters of the Constitution. Well, that was actually 1857. And so I read all these cases now, and I'm always thinking in terms of 1857 instead of when they actually voted on the Constitution. The sovereign immunity concept was that you just couldn't sue the state. You know, back then, when you first enacted it, you could not bring a civil action, a tort action against the state because the king could do no wrong. The state could do no wrong. So you just could not sue them. And one of the first laws adopted after we became a state was something saying, well, yes, you can, but only to limited degrees. They didn't say, we're going to completely give up our immunity. We're not going to say you can sue us for anything. We're going to say you can sue us, but you're only going to be able to sue us up to certain amounts. And in the case of the current law, it's basically like $100,000 for like a personal injury to the person. So the state has said, go ahead, you can sue us, but if you have damages of more than $100,000, we're not going to pay them.
And is it that provision that that makes it possible for physicians at OHSU to have malpractice caps because of their connection to the state?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
It's my understanding that physicians at OHSU
mm-hmm.
are correct. Capped in terms correct. Of their liability. Is it
correct.
Because of
that?
It's
because of the Torts Claim Act. The state is self-insured. We have our own insurance company. It's operated by the Department of Administrative Services. It's actually called the Risk Management Division. And they charge all of the agency's premiums for their insurance. And in fact, our office pays a premium for insurance for our office. We have a very small premium because, like with most insurance, it's based on what your risk is, what's happened to you. How many claims have you made? We haven't made any claims. We don't pay very much. But, and also, it doesn't cost agencies that much because we have these caps. If we lose the cap someday because of a case or something, those costs are going to go up substantially for state agencies because if we have unlimited liability for public bodies, it's going to get much more expensive. And that has happened in some other states. Washington did it voluntarily, I believe. They removed the caps, and it shoved up the cost quite a bit for doing their own self-insurance. So the last thing I want to talk about is just a little bit about constitutionality, because that has been a very significant issue for court actions over the last years, especially starting in 1999 with the Lakin case. Back in the 1987 bill that I mentioned, the huge bill that was passed back then, was a provision that said that a plaintiff could not recover more than $500,000 in non-economic damages. As you remember, non-economic damages are primarily pain and suffering type recovery. The Lakin case said that that provision was unconstitutional and a violation under Oregon's constitutional right to jury trial. The net result of that was we've had actually two referrals now. Right after Lakin came down in 1999, the legislature referred out a measure to allow caps on non-economic damages. It went down by a substantial vote in year 2000. And then we've had, of course, the one in the last election that came very close to passing, which would have been limited to medical malpractice cases. The one in 2000 was any. It just basically authorized caps on non-economic damages. Lakin has had several cases that come along afterwards that have, at least in my mind, left a lot of confusion about what you can and can't do as far as limiting liability. I'm tempted to ask judges when I run into them here, but they, of course, couldn't comment on that anyway. We're kind of stuck with what they said, not with what they might say down the line at some point. But I'm particularly concerned with respect to such issues as the Torts Claim Act and things like that. They have upheld the Torts Claim Act primarily in a case that came down, and that's the Jensen v. Whitwell case that's down at the very bottom, primarily because they said the legislature had provided an alternative remedy. What they said was is that, you know, no, you can't go sue the employee under the Torts Claim Act. That's what the Torts Claim Act says. If you go to sue, if I'm driving on state business and I have an accident, and it's my fault, and the person I run into says, I'm going to sue you, state Hendricks, and they file a complaint against me in the court, what the court's going to do is say, Mr. Hendricks is in the course and scope of his employment, he's covered by the Torts Claim Act, his employer must defend him under the Torts Claim Act, and they will literally take me out of the case and say, and substitute my employer, Legislative Assembly, as being the proper defendant. The court in the Jensen case said that's okay because even though you can't sue Mr. Hendricks, you get to sue the Legislative Assembly. So you have an alternative remedy that you can turn to. One of the questions not answered by that case, though, was whether or not what we had provided in this alternative remedy was an adequate remedy. Now, and that's a case-by-case determination. And they didn't have to decide in Jensen because they didn't know how much it's going to be awarded. If, for instance, I had a $2 million, I had cost $2 million in damages to this person, and they came in and said, look, I'm only going to get $100,000 because of the Torts Claim Act, it's going to be interesting to see when that case comes along what the Supreme Court says. There are also other difficult answers, questions here about all the other statutes we have that are limitations on liability. We haven't had a case where, as far as I know, where people have challenged some of those statutes based on the Lakin case analysis. For instance, the one on public lands just worked fine. I mean, it went through. I think it worked the way it was supposed to. The question is, there, as far as I know, there was no Lakin challenge made to it, and I'll be curious to see when one of those cases come along if, what the court's finally said. I hope that's helpful. A little court background. Happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. This is very helpful. I think at some point we might want to have you back. So thank you very much, Dave. Sorry we made you wait. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Committee, we have, before we lose our quorum, we have a couple of bill introductions, and we may do those very quickly. Council O'Leary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. LC 940 relating to agency enforcement authority is sponsored by the Judiciary Committee at the request of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. LC 1621 relating to incarceration is sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. LC 1622 relating to criminal sentences and providing for criminal sentence reduction that requires approval by a two-thirds majority is sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. And LC 1623 also relating to sentencing and providing for criminal sentence reduction that requires a approval by two-thirds majority sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. And finally, LC 1653 relating to health care, sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary, and I have a note that the relating clause has been redrafted on that LC.
Thank you. Senator Starr?
Sorry, I didn't hear that last.
The note that I have indicates that the relating clause on LC 1653 has been redrafted.
Can we hold that one until we see the new relating clause?
Yeah, Senator Starr, I think when they redraft a relating clause, it's because I just had this happen on one of my bills. It's actually just a technical thing where the relating clause doesn't fit. But you have the version here, right, that is redrafted. Is that correct? Or is it the old version?
I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, let's hold it. We'll hold it and make sure that, because we can just do it Monday or tomorrow.
I can hazard a guess, but I'm not absolutely sure.
Yeah, let's hold it till
sure.
Tomorrow. We're still beyond the deadline. Senator Starr?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that we draft this committee bills, LC 940, LC 1621, LC 1622, and LC 1623.
Okay, great. Thank you. Senator Starr has moved the aforementioned LCs be introduced as Judiciary Committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Committee, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. We're starting at 8:30 in the Multnomah County Courthouse. As I said before, we'll have an hour of informational meeting with the Chief Judges of Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County Courts. The Multnomah County Courts will describe some of their drug courts to us, and Clackamas County will talk about their mental health court, which is somewhat unique in the state. And Washington County will talk about their restitution program that they have out there. So I look forward to seeing you all, and go ahead and get rides if you need them. And with that, we are adjourned.